answered. "Yes," Jude said. "I believe he's been away. But he just came back."
"Did he?"
she replied, more puzzled by the moment.
"Maybe you know better than I do."
"Not me," he said, pouring himself another brandy. "Taylor."
"Taylor? What are you talking about?"
Clem downed the liquor.
"You're going to say I'm crazy, but hear me out, will you?"
"I'm listening."
"I haven't been sentimental about losing him. I haven't sat at home reading his love letters and listening to the songs we danced to. I've tried to get out and be useful for a change. But I have left his room the way it was. I couldn't bring myself to go through his clothes or even strip the bed. I kept putting it off. And the more I didn't do it, the more impossible it seemed to be. Then tonight, I came in just after 8, and I heard somebody talking."
Every particle of Clem's body but his lips was still as he spoke, transfixed by the memory.
"I thought I'd left the radio on. But no, I realised it was coming from upstairs, from his bedroom. It was him, Judy, talking clear as day, calling me up the way he used to. I was so afraid I almost fled. Stupid, isn't it? There I was, praying and praying for some sign he was in God's hands, and as soon as it came I practically shat myself. I'll tell you, I was half an hour on the stairs hoping he'd stop calling me, and sometimes he did for a while, and I'd half convinced myself I'd imagined it. Then he'd start again. Nothing melodramatic, just him trying to persuade me not to be afraid and come up and say hello. So, eventually, that's what I did."
His eyes were filling with tears, but there was no grief in his voice.
"He liked that room in the evening. The sun fills it up. That's what it was like tonight, full of sun. And he was there, in the light. I couldn't see him, but I knew he was next to me because he said so. He told me I looked well. Then he said, 'It's a glad day, Clem. Gentle came back, and he's got the answers.'"
"What answers?" Jude said.
"That's what I asked him. I said, 'What answers, Tay?' But you know Tay, when he's happy, he gets delirious, like a child."
Clem spoke with a smile, his gaze on sights remembered from better days.
"He was so full of the fact that Gentle was back, I couldn't get much more from him."
Clem looked up at Jude.
"The light was going," he said, "and I think he wanted to go with it. He said that it was our duty to help Gentle. That was why he was showing himself to me this way. It wasn't easy, he said, but then neither was being a guardian angel. And I said, 'Why only one? One angel when there's two of us?' And he said, 'Because we are one, Clem, you and I. We always were and we always will be.' Those were his exact words, I swear. Then he went away. And you know what I kept thinking?"
"What?"
"That I wished I hadn't waited on the stairs and wasted all that time I could have had with him."
Clem set down his glass, pulled a tissue from his pocket and blew his nose.
"That's all," he said.
"I think that's plenty."
"I know what you're thinking," he said with a little laugh. "You're thinking, poor Clem. He couldn't grieve, so he's having hallucinations."
"No," she said very softly. "I'm thinking, Gentle doesn't know how lucky he is, having angels like you two."
"Don't humour me."
"I'm not," she said. "I believe everything you've just told me happened."
"You do?"
"Yes."
Again a laugh.
"Why?"
"Because Gentle came home tonight, Clem, and I was the only one who knew it."
He left 10 minutes later, apparently content to know that even if he was crazy, there was another lunatic in his circle he could turn to when he wanted to share his insanities. Jude told him as much as she felt able at this juncture, which was very little, but she promised to contact Gentle on Clem's behalf and tell him about Taylor's visitation. Clem wasn't so grateful that he was blinded to her discretion.
"You know a lot more than you're telling me, don't you?" he said.
"Yes," she said, "but maybe in a little while I'll be able to tell you more."
"Is Gentle in danger?" Clem asked. "Can you tell me that at least?"
"We all are," she said. "You, me, Gentle, Taylor."
"Taylor's dead," Clem said. "He's in the light. Nothing can hurt him."
"I hope you're right," she said grimly. "But please, Clem, if he finds you again,
he will..."
Then when he does, tell him nobody's safe. Just because Gentle's back in the... back home doesn't mean the troubles are over. In fact, they're just beginning.
Tay says something sublime's going to happen.
That's his word, sublime. And maybe it will. But there's a lot of room for error. And if anything goes wrong...
She halted, her head filled with memories of the Inn Ovo and the ruins of Isordorex.
Well, whenever you feel you can tell me, Clem said, we'll be ready to hear. Both of us.
He glanced at his watch.
I should be out of here. I'm late.
Party?
No, I'm working with a hospice for the homeless. We're out most nights trying to get kids off the streets. The city's full of them.
She took him to the door, but before he stepped out, he said,
you remember our pagan party at Christmas?
She grinned.
Of course. That was quite a shindig.
Tay got stinking drunk after everybody had gone. He knew he wasn't going to be seeing most of them again. Then, of course, he got sick in the middle of the night, so we stayed up together talking about, oh, I don't know, everything under the sun. And he told me how much he'd always loved Gentle. How Gentle was the mystery man in his life. He'd been dreaming about him, he said, speaking in tongues.
He told me the same thing, Jude said.
Then out of the blue, he said that next year I should have the Nativity back and go to Midnight Mass the way we used to, and I told him I thought we decided none of that made much sense. And you know what he said to me? He said, light was light, whatever name you call it, and it was better to think of it coming in a face you knew.
Clem smiled.
I thought he was talking about Christ. But now... now I'm not so sure.
She hugged him hard, pressing her lips against his flushed cheek. Though she suspected that there was truth in what he said, she couldn't bring herself to voice the possibility. Not knowing that the same face Tay had imagined as that of the returning sun was also the face of the darkness that might soon eclipse them all. Chapter 8 1 Though the bed Gentle had collapsed into the night before had been stale, and the pillow beneath his head damp, he couldn't have slept more soundly had he been rocked in the arms of Mother Earth herself. When he woke, 15 hours later, it was to a fine June morning, and the dreamless time behind him had put new strength into his sinews. There was no gas, electricity, or hot water, so he was obliged to shower and shave in cold water, which was respectively a bracing and a bloody experience. That done, he took some time to assess the state of the studio. It had not remained entirely untouched in his absence. At some juncture, either an old girlfriend or a very particular thief had come in. He'd left two of the windows open, so gaining access had presented no difficulty, and the interloper had stolen both clothes and more private bric-a-brac. It was such a long time since he'd been here, however, that he couldn't remember precisely what was missing. Some letters and postcards from the mantelpiece, a few photographs, though he'd not liked to be recorded this way for what were now obvious reasons, and a few items of jewellery, a gold chain, two rings, a crucifix. The theft didn't much bother him. He'd never been a sentimentalist or a hoarder. Objects were like glossy magazines, fetching for a day, then readily discarded. There were other, more disgusting signs of his absence in the bathroom, where clothes he'd left to dry before his departure had grown green fur, and in the refrigerator, the shelves of which were scattered with what looked like pupating zarzai, stinking of putrefaction. Before he could really begin to clean up, he had to have some power in the house, and to get it would require some politicking. He'd had the gas, telephone, and electricity cut off in the past, when in the lean times between forgeries and sugar mamas, he'd run out of funds. But he had the patter to get them turned on again well-honed, and that had to be the priority of the hour. He dressed in the freshest of his clothes and went downstairs to present himself to the venerable but dotty Mrs. Erskine, who occupied the ground-floor flat. It was she who let him in the day before, remarking with her characteristic candour that he looked as though he'd been kicked half to death, to which he'd replied that he felt the same way. She didn't question his absence, which was not surprising given that his occupation of the studio had always been sporadic, but she did ask him if he was going to be staying a while this time. He said he thought so, and she replied that she was pleased at this, because during these summer days people always got crazy, and since Mr. Erskine's death she was sometimes frightened. She made tea while he availed himself of her telephone, calling around the services he'd lost. It turned out to be a frustrating business. He'd lost the knack of charming the women he spoke to into some action on his behalf. Instead of an exchange of flatteries, he was served a chilly salad of officiousness and condescension. He had unpaid bills, he was told, and his supplies would not be reconnected until payment was forthcoming. He ate some toast Mrs. Erskine had made, drank several cups of tea, then went down into the basement and left a note for the caretaker that he was now back in residence, and could he please have his hot water turned on. That done, he ascended to the studio again and bolted the door behind him. One conversation for the day was enough, he'd decided. He drew the blinds at the windows and lit two candles. They smoked as their dusty wicks first burned, but their light was kinder than the glare of the day, and by it he started to go through the snowdrift of mail that had gathered behind the door. There were bills, in abundance, of course, printed in increasingly irate colours, plus the inevitable junk mail. There were very few personal letters, but among them were two that gave him pause. Both were from Vanessa, whose advice that he should slit his lying throat had found such a distressing echo in Athanasius's exhortation at the erasure. Now she wrote that she missed him, and a day didn't go by without her thinking of him. The second missive was even more direct. She wanted him back in her life. If he wanted to play around with other women, she would learn to accommodate that. Would he not at least make contact with her? Life was too short to bear grudges on either side. He was buoyed up somewhat by her appeals, and even more so by a letter from Klein scrawled in red ink on pink paper. Chester's faintly camp tones rose from the page as Gentle scanned it. "Dear bastard boy," Klein had written, "whose heart are you breaking and where? Scores of forlorn women are presently weeping on my lap, begging me to forgive you your trespasses and invite you back into the bosom of the family. Among them, the delectable Vanessa. For God's sake, come home and save me from seducing her. My groin is wet for you." So Vanessa had gone to Klein. Desperation indeed. Though she'd met Chester only once that Gentle could recall, she'd subsequently professed to loathing him. Gentle kept all three letters, though he had no intention of acting upon their appeals. And there was only one reunion he was eager for, and that was with the house in Clerkenwell. He couldn't face the idea of venturing out in daylight, however. The streets would be too bright and too busy. He'd wait until dark, when he could move across the city as the invisible he aspired to be. He set a match to the rest of the letters and watched them burn. Then he went back to bed and slept through the afternoon in preparation for the business of the night. 2. He waited until the first stars appeared in a sky of elegiac blue before he raised the blinds. The street outside was quiet, but given that he lacked the cash for a cab, he knew he'd have to brush shoulders with a lot of people before he reached Clerkenwell. On a fine evening like this, the Edgware Road would be busy and there'd be crowds on the underground. His best hope of reaching his destination unscrutinised was to dress as blandly as possible, and he took some time hunting through his depleted wardrobe for those clothes that would render him most invisible. Once dressed, he walked down to Marble Arch and boarded the underground. It was only 5 stations to Chancery Lane, which would put him on the borders of Clerkenwell, but after 2 he had to get off, gasping and sweating like a claustrophobic. Cursing this new weakness in himself, he sat in the station for 30 minutes while more trains passed through, unable to bring himself to board. What an irony. Here he was, a sometime wanderer in the wilds of the Imagica, incapable of travelling a couple of miles by tube without panicking. He waited until his shaking subsided and a less crowded train came along. Then he re-boarded, sitting close to the door with his head in his hands, until the journey was over. By the time he emerged at Chancery Lane, the sky had darkened and he stood for several minutes on High Holborn, his head thrown back, soaking up the sky. Only when the tremors had left his legs did he head up Gray's Inn Road towards the environs of Gamut Street. Almost all the property on the main thoroughfares had long since been turned to commercial use, but there was a network of streets and squares behind the barricade of darkened office buildings which, protected perhaps by the patronage of notoriety, had been left untouched by the developers. Many of these streets were narrow and mazy, their lamps unlit, their signs missing, as though blind eyes had been turned to them over the generations. But he didn't need signs and lamps. His feet had trodden these ways countless times. Here was Shiverick Square, with its little park all overgrown, and Flaxon Street, and Almoth, and Stern, and in their midst, cocooned by anonymity, his destination. He saw the corner of Gamut Street 20 yards ahead and slowed his pace to take pleasure in the moment of reunion. There were innumerable memories awaiting him there, the mischief among them, but not all would be so sweet, or so welcome. He would have to ingest them carefully, like a diner with a delicate stomach coming to a lavish table. Moderation was the way. As soon as he felt a surfeit, he'd retreat and return to the studio to digest what he'd learned, let it strengthen him. Only then would he return for a second helping. The process would take time, he knew, and time was of the essence, but so was his sanity. What use would he be as a reconciler if he choked on the past? With his heart thumping hard, he came to the corner and, turning it, finally laid his eyes upon the sacred street. Perhaps, during his years of forgetfulness, he'd wandered through these backwaters all unknowing and seen the sight before him now, but he doubted it. More likely, his eyes were seeing Gamut Street for the first time in 2 centuries. It had changed scarcely at all, preserved from the city planners and their hammer-wielding hordes by the fates whose makers were still rumoured here. The trees planted along the pavement were weighed down with unkempt foliage, but their sap's tang was sharp. The air protected from the fumes of Holborn and Gray's Inn Road by the warren of thoroughfares between. Was it just his fancy, or was the tree outside number 28 particularly lush, fed perhaps by a seepage of magics from the step of the maestro's house? He began towards them, tree and step, the memories already returning in force. He heard the children singing behind him, the song that had so tormented him when the autarch had told him who he was. Sartori, he'd said. And this charmless ditty, sung by piping voices, had come in pursuit of the name. He'd loathed it, then. Its melody was banal, its words were nonsense, but now he remembered how he'd first heard it, walking along this very pavement, with the children in procession on the opposite shore, and how flattered he'd been that he was famous enough to have reached the lips of children who'd never read or write, or most probably reached the age of puberty. All of London knew who he was, and he liked his fame. He was talked about at court, Roxburgh said, and should soon expect an invitation. People who'd not so much as touched his sleeve were claiming intimate association. But there were still those, thank God, who kept an exquisite distance, and one such soul had lived, he remembered, in the house opposite. A nymph called Allegra, who liked to sit at her dressing table near the window with her bodice half unlaced, knowing she had an admirer in the maestro across the street. She'd had a little curly-haired dog, and sometimes in the evening he'd hear her piping voice summon the lucky hound onto her lap, where she'd let it snuggle. One afternoon, a few paces from where he stood now, he'd met the girl out walking with her mother and had made much of the dog, suffering its little tongue on his mouth for the smell of her sex in its fur. What had become of that child? Had she died a virgin or grown old and fat, wondering about the man who'd been her most ardent admirer? He glanced up at the window where Allegra had sat. No light burned in it now. The house, like almost all these buildings, was dark. Sighing, he turned his gaze towards number 28, and crossing the street, went to the door. It was locked, of course, but one of the lower windows had been broken at some point and never repaired. He reached through the smashed pane and unlocked it, then slid the window up and himself inside. Slowly, he reminded himself. Go slowly. Keep the flow under control. It was dark, but he'd come prepared for that eventuality, with candle and matches. The flame guttered at first, and the room rocked at its indecision, but by degrees it strengthened, and he felt a sensation he'd not expected, swelling like the light. Pride. In its time, this, his house, had been a place of great souls and great ambition, where all commonplace debate had been banned. If you wanted to talk politics or tittle-tattle, you went to the coffee house. If you wanted commerce, to the exchange. Here, only miracles. Here, only the rising of the spirit. And, yes, love, if it was pertinent, which it was so often, and sometimes bloodletting, but never the prosaic, never the trivial. Here the man who brought the strangest tale was the most welcome. Here every excess was celebrated if it brought visions, and every vision analysed for the hints it held to the nature of the everlasting. He lifted the candle and, holding it high, began to walk through the house. The rooms, there were many, were badly dilapidated, the boards creaking under his feet, weakened by rot and worm, the walls mapping continents of damp. But the present didn't insist upon him for long. By the time he reached the bottom of the stairs, memory was lighting candles everywhere, their luminescence spilling through the dining room door and from the rooms above. It was a generous light, clothing naked walls, putting lush carpets underfoot, and setting fine furniture on their pile. Though the debaters here might have aspired to pure spirit, they were not averse to comforting the flesh, while still cursed with it. Who would have guessed, seeing the modest facade of the house from the street, that the interior would be so finely furnished and ornamented? And seeing these glories appear, he heard the voices of those who'd wallowed in that luxury. Laughter first, then vociferous arguments from somebody at the top of the stairs. He couldn't see the debaters yet. Perhaps his mind, which he'd instructed in caution, was holding the flood back, but he could put names to both of them, sight unseen. One was Horace Tyrwhitt, the other Isaac Abelove. And the laughter? That was Joshua Godolphin, of course. He had a laugh like the devil's laugh, full and throaty.
"Come on, then," Gentle said aloud to the memories. "I'm ready to see your faces."
And as he spoke, they came. Tyrwhitt on the stairs, overdressed and overpowdered as ever, keeping his distance from Abelove in case the magpie his pursuer was nursing flew free.
"It's bad luck," Tyrwhitt was protesting. "Birds in the house are bad luck."
"Luck's for fishermen and gamblers," Abelove replied.
"One of these days you'll turn a phrase worth remembering," Tyrwhitt replied. "Just get the thing out before I wring its neck."
He turned towards Gentle.
"Tell him, Sartori."
Gentle was shocked to see the memory's eyes fix so acutely upon him.
"It does no harm," he found himself replying. "It's one of God's creatures."
At which point the bird rose flapping from Abe Love's grasp, emptying its bowels as it did so on the man's wig and face, which brought a hoot of laughter from Tyrwhitt.
"Now don't wipe it off," he told Abe Love as the magpie fluttered away. "It's good luck."
The sound of his laughter brought Joshua Godolphin, imperious as ever, out of the dining room.
"What's the row?"
Abelove was already clattering after the bird, his calls merely alarming it more. It fluttered around the hallway in panic, cawing as it went.
"Open the damned door," Godolphin said. "Let the bloody thing out."
"And spoil the sport," Tyrwhitt said.
"If everyone would but calm their voices," Abelove said, "it would settle." "Why did you bring it in?" Joshua wanted to know. "It was sitting on the step," Abelove replied. "I thought it was injured." "It looks quite well to me," Godolphin said, and turned his face, ruddied with brandy, towards Gentle. "Maestro," he said, inclining his head a little, "I'm afraid we began dinner without you. Come in. Leave these bird brains to play."
Gentle was crossing to the dining room, when there was a thud behind him, and he turned to see the bird dropping to the floor beneath one of the windows where it had struck the glass. Abelove let out a little moan, and Tyrwhitt's laughter ceased.
"There now," he said, "you killed the thing."
"Not me," Abelove said.
"You want to resurrect it,"
Joshua murmured to Gentle, his tone conspiratorial.
"With a broken neck and wings," Gentle mourned, "that wouldn't be very kind."
"But amusing,"
Godolphin replied, with mischief in his puffy eyes.
"I think not," Gentle said, and saw his distaste wipe the humour off Joshua's face. He's a little afraid of me, Gentle thought. The power in me makes him nervous. Joshua headed into the dining room, and Gentle was about to step through the door after him when a young man, 18 at most, with a plain long face and chorister's curls, came to his side.
Maestro, he said.
Unlike Joshua and the others, these features seemed more familiar to Gentle. Perhaps there was a certain modernity in the languid, lidded gaze and the small, almost effeminate mouth. He didn't look that intelligent, in truth, but his words when they came were well turned, despite the boy's nervousness. He barely dared look at Sartori, but with those lids downcast, begged the maestro's indulgence.
I wondered, sir, if you had perhaps considered the matter of which we spoke.
Gentle was about to ask, what matter? When his tongue replied, his intellect seizing the memory as the words spilled out. I know how eager you are, Lucius. Lucius Cobbett was the boy's name. At 17 he already had the great works by heart, or at least their theses. Ambitious and apt at politics, he'd taken Tirrit as a patron, for what services only his bed knew, but it was surely a hanging offence, and had secured himself a place in the house as a menial. But he wanted more than that, and scarcely an evening went by without his politely plying the maestro with coy glances and pleas.
I'm more than eager, sir, he said. I've studied all the rituals. I've mapped the Inovo from what I've read in Flute's Visions. They're just beginnings, I know, but I've also copied all the known glyphs, and I have them by heart.
He had a little skill as an artist, too. Something else they shared, besides ambition and dubious morals.
I can help you, maestro, he was saying. You're going to need somebody beside you on the night.
I commend you on your discipline, Lucius, but the reconciliation's a dangerous business. I can't take the responsibility.
I'll take that, sir.
Besides, I have my assistant. The boy's face fell.
You do?
He said. Certainly. Pi o pa.
You trust your life to a familiar?
Why shouldn't I?
Well, because it's not even human.
That's why I trust it, Lucius, Gentle said. I'm sorry to disappoint you.
Could I at least watch, sir? I'll keep my distance, I swear. Everybody else is going to be there.
This was true enough. As the night of the reconciliation approached, the size of the audience swelled. His patrons, who'd at first taken their oaths of secrecy very seriously, now sensed triumph and had become indiscreet. In hushed and often embarrassed tones, they'd admit to having invited a friend or a relation to witness the rites, and who was he, the performer, to forbid his paymasters their moment of reflected glory? Though he never gave them an easy time when they made these confessions, he didn't much mind. Admiration charged the blood, and when the reconciliation had been achieved, the more tongues there were to say they'd seen it done and sanctify the doer, the better.
I beg you, sir, Lucius was saying, I'll be in your debt forever.
Gentle nodded, ruffling the youth's ginger hair. You may watch, he said. Tears started to the boy's eyes, and he snatched up Gentle's hand, laying his lips to it.
I am the luckiest man in England, he said. Thank you, sir, thank you.
Quieting the boy's profusions, Gentle left him at the door and stepped through into the dining room. As he did so, he wondered if all these events and conversations had actually dovetailed in this fashion, or whether his memory was collecting fragments from different nights and days, knitting them together so that they appeared seamless. If the latter was the case, and he guessed it was, then there were probably clues in these scenes to mysteries yet to be unveiled, and he should try to remember their every detail. But it was difficult. He was both Gentle and Sartori here, both witness and actor. It was hard to live the moments when he was also observing them, and harder still to dig for the seam of their significance, when their surface gleamed so fetchingly, and when he was the brightest jewel that shone there. How they had idolized him! He'd been like a divinity among them, his every belch and fart attended to like a sermon, his cosmological pronouncements, of which he was too fond, greeted with reverence and gratitude even by the mightiest. Three of those mighty awaited him in the dining room, gathered at one end of a table, set for four but laden with sufficient food to sate the street for a week. Joshua was one of the trio, of course. Roxburgh and his long-time foil, Oliver McGann, were the others.
the latter well in his cups, the former as ever keeping his counsel, his ascetic features dominated by the long hook of his nose, always half-masked by his hands. He despised his mouth, Gentle thought, because it betrayed his nature, which, despite his incalculable wealth and his pretensions to metaphysics, was peevish, penurious, and sullen.
"Religion's for the faithful," McGann was loudly opining. "They say their prayers aren't answered, and their faith increases. Whereas magic—"
He stopped, laying his inebriated gaze on the maestro at the door.
"Ah, the very man, the very man! Tell him, Sartori, tell him what magic is."
Roxburgh had made a pyramid of his fingers, the apex at the bridge of his nose.
"Yes, maestro," he said, "do tell."
"My pleasure," Gentle replied, taking the glass of wine McGann poured for him and wetting his throat before he provided tonight's profundities. "Magic is the first and last religion of the world," he said. "It has the power to make us whole, to open our eyes to the dominions and return us to ourselves."
"That sounds very fine," Roxburgh said flatly. "But what does it mean?"
"It's obvious what it means," McGann protested.
"Not to me, it isn't."
"It means we're born divided, Roxburgh," the maestro replied. "But we long for union."
"Oh, we do, do we?"
"I believe so."
"And why should we seek union with ourselves?" Roxburgh said. "Tell me that. I would have thought we're the only company we're certain we have."
There was a riling smugness to the man's tone, but the maestro had heard these niceties before and had his answers well honed. "Everything that isn't us is also ourselves," he said. He came to the table and set down his glass, peering through the smoky candle flames at Roxburgh's black eyes. "We're joined to everything that was, is, and will be," he said, "from one end of the Imagica to another, from the tiniest mote dancing over this flame to the Godhead itself." He took breath, leaving room for a retort from Roxburgh, but none came. "We'll not be subsumed at our deaths," he went on. "We'll be increased to the size of creation."
"Yes!"
McGann said, the word coming long and loud from between teeth clenched in a tigerish smile.
"Magic's our means to that revelation," the maestro said, "while we're still in our flesh."
"And is it your opinion that we are given that revelation?"
Roxburgh replied.
"Or are we stealing it?"
"We were born to know as much as we can know.
We were born to suffer in our flesh," Roxburgh said.
"You may suffer. I don't."
The reply won a guffaw from McGann.
"The flesh isn't punishment," the maestro said. "It's there for joy. But it also marks the place where we end and the rest of creation begins, or so we believe. It's an illusion, of course."
"Good," said Godolphin. "I like that."
"So are we about God's business or not?" Roxburgh wanted to know. "Are you having second thoughts?"
"Third and fourth, more like," McGann said.
Roxburgh gave the man at his side a sour glance.
"Did we swear an oath not to doubt?" he said. "I don't think so. Why should I be castigated because I ask a simple question?"
"I apologize," McGann said. "Tell the man, maestro. We're doing God's work, aren't we?"
"Does God want us to be more than we are?" Gentle said.
"Of course. Does God want us to love, which is the desire to be joined and made whole?"
"Of course."
"Does it want us in its glory forever and ever?"
"Yes, it does."
"You always say it,"
McGann observed.
"Why is that?"
"Creation and its maker are one and the same. True or false?"
"True."
"And creation's as full of women as it is of men. True or false?"
"Oh, true, true."
"Indeed, I give thanks for the fact night and day," Gentle said, glancing at Godolphin as he spoke. "Beside my bed and in it."
Joshua laughed his devil's laugh.
"So the Godhead is both male
and female. For convenience, an it.
"Bravely said," Joshua announced. "I never tire of hearing you speak, Sartori. My thoughts get muddy, but after I've listened to you a while, they're like spring water, straight from the rock."
"Not too clean, I hope," the maestro said. "We don't want any Puritan souls spoiling the reconciliation."
"You know me better than that,"
Joshua said, catching Gentle's eye. Even as he did so, Gentle had proof of his suspicion that these encounters, though remembered in one continuous stream, had not occurred sequentially, but were fragments his mind was knitting together as the rooms he was walking through evoked them. McGann and Roxburgh faded from the table, as did most of the candlelight and the litter of carafes, glasses, and food it had illuminated. Now there was only Joshua and himself, and the house was still above and below, everyone asleep but for these conspirators.
"I wanted to be with you when you performed the working,"
Joshua was saying. There was no hint of laughter now. He looked harassed and nervous.
"She's very precious to me, Sartori. If anything were to happen to her, I'd lose my mind."
"She'll be perfectly safe," the maestro said, sitting down at the table. There was a map of the Imagico laid out in front of him, with the names of the maestros and their assistants in each dominion marked beside their places of conjuration. He scanned them and found he knew one or two. Tick Raw was there, as the deputy to Utamuski. Skopeek was there too, marked as an assistant to Herate Hamriok. The latter a distant relation, perhaps, of the Hamriok whom Gentle and Pye had encountered in Vanef. Names from two pasts intersecting here on the map.
"Are you listening to me?"
Joshua said. "I told you she'd be perfectly safe," came the maestro's reply. "The workings are delicate, but they're not dangerous."
"Then let me be there,"
Godolphin said, wringing his hands.
"I'll be your assistant instead of that wretched mistiff.
I haven't even told Pi Opa what we're up to. This is our business, and only ours. You just bring Judith here tomorrow evening, and I'll see to the rest."
"She's so vulnerable."
"She seems very self-possessed to me," the maestro observed.
"Very heated."
Godolphin's fretful expression soured into ice.
"Don't parade it, Sartori," he said. "It's not enough that I've got Roxburgh at my ear all yesterday telling me he doesn't trust you. I have to bear you parading your arrogance."
"Roxburgh understands nothing."
"He says you're obsessed with women, so he understands that, at least. You watch some girl across the street, he says."
"What if I do?"
"How can you give yourself to the reconciliation if you're so distracted? Are you trying to talk me out of wanting Judith?" "I thought magic was a religion to you."
"So's she."
"A discipline, a sacred mystery."
"Again, so's she," he laughed. "When I first saw her, it was like my first glimpse of another world. I knew I'd risk my life to be inside her skin. When I'm with her, I feel like an adept again, creeping towards a miracle step by step, tentative, excited."
"Enough!"
"Really? You don't want to know why I need to be inside her so badly?" Godolphin eyed him ruefully.
"Not really," he said. "But if you don't tell me, I'll only wonder."
"Because for a little time I'll forget who I am. Everything petty and particular will go out of me. My ambition, my history, everything. I'll be unmade. And that's when I'm closest to divinity."
"Somehow you always manage to bring everything back to that, even your lust.
It's all one."
"I don't like your talk of the one," Godolphin said. "You sound like Roxburgh with his dictums. Simplicity is strength and all the rest."
"That's not what I mean, and you know it. It's just that women are where everything begins, and I like, how shall I put it, to touch the source as often as possible."
"You think you're perfect, don't you?"
Godolphin said. "Why so sour? A week ago you were doting on my every word."
"I don't like what we're doing,"
Godolphin replied.
"I want Judith for myself."
"You'll have her. And so will I. That's the glory of this."
"There'll be no difference between them?"
"None. They'll be identical, to the pucker, to the lash."
"So why must I have the copy?"
"You know the answer to that."
because the original loves me, not you.
I should never have let you set eyes on her.
You couldn't have kept us apart. Don't look so forlorn. I'm going to make you a Judith that'll dote on you and your son's sons until the name Godolphin disappears off the face of the earth. Now where's the harm in that?
As he asked the question, all the candles but the one he held went out, and the past was extinguished with them. He was suddenly back in the empty house, a police siren whooping nearby. He stepped back into the hallway as the car sped down Gamut Street, its blue light pulsing through the windows. Seconds later, another came howling after. Though the din of the sirens faded and finally disappeared, the flashes did not. They brightened from blue to white, however, and lost their regularity. By their brilliance, he saw the house once more restored to glory. It was no longer a place of debate and laughter, however. There was sobbing above and below, and the animal smells of fear in every corner. Thunder rattled the roof, but there was no rain to soothe its collar. "I don't want to be here," he thought. The other memories had entertained him. He'd liked his role in the proceedings, but this darkness was another matter entirely. It was full of death, and he wanted to run from it. The lightning came again, horribly livid. By it he saw Lucius Cobbett standing halfway up the stairs, clutching the banister as though he'd fall if he didn't. He'd bitten his tongue, or lip, or both, and blood dribbled from his mouth and chin, made stringy by the spit with which it was mingled. When Gentle climbed the stairs, he smelt excrement. The boy had loosed his bowels in his breeches. Seeing Gentle, he raised his eyes.
"How did it fail, Maestro?" he sobbed. "How?"
Gentle shuddered as the question brought images flooding into his head, more horrendous than all the scenes he'd witnessed at the erasure. The failure of the reconciliation had been sudden and calamitous, and had caught the maestros representing the five dominions at such a delicate time in the working that they'd been ill-equipped to prevent it. The spirits of all five had already risen from their circles across Imagica, and, carrying the analogues of their worlds, had converged on the Ana, the zone of inviolability that appeared every two centuries in the heart of the Inovo. There, for a tender time, miracles could be worked, as the maestros, safe from the Inovo's inhabitants but freed and empowered by their immaterial state, unburdened themselves of their similitudes and allowed the genius of the Ana to complete the fusing of the dominions. It was a precarious time, but they'd been reaching its conclusion when the circle in which the Maestro Sartori's physical body sat, its stones protecting the outside world from the flux which let on to the Inovo, broke. Of all the potential places for failure in the ceremonies, this was the unlikeliest. Tantamount to transubstantiation failing for want of salt in the bread. But fail it did, and once the breach was opened there was no way to seal it until the maestros had returned to their bodies and mustered their fates. In that time the hungry tenants of the Inovo had free access to the fifth. Not only to the fifth, but to the exalted flesh of the maestros themselves, who vacated the Ana in confusion, leading the hounds of the Inovo back to their flesh. Sartori's life would certainly have been forfeited, along with all the others, had Pai Opa not intervened. When the circle broke, Pai was being forcibly removed from the retreat on Godolphin's order for voicing a prophetic murmur of alarm and disturbing the audience. The duty of removal had fallen to Abe Love and Lucius Cobbett, but neither had possessed the strength to hold the mischief. It had broken free, racing across the retreat and plunging into the circle where its master was visible to the assembly only as a blaze of light. The mischief had learned well at Sartori's feet. It had defences against the flux of power that roared in the circle, and had pulled the maestro from under the noses of the approaching Oviats. The rest of the assembly, however, caught between the mischief's yells of warning and Roxburgh's attempts to maintain the status quo, were still standing around in confusion when the Oviats appeared. The entities were swift. One moment the retreat was a bridge to the transcendental, the next it was an abattoir. Dazed by his sudden fall from grace, the maestro had seen only snatches of the massacre, but they were burned on his eyes, and Gentle remembered them now in all their wretched detail. Abe Love, scrabbling at the ground in terror, as an Oviate the size of a felled bull, but resembling something barely born, opened its toothless maw and drew him between its jaws with tongues the length of whips. McGann, losing his arm to a sleek, dark animal that rippled as it ran, but hauling himself away, his blood a scarlet fountain, while the thing was distracted by fresher meat, and Flores. Poor Flores, who'd come to Gamut Street the day before carrying a letter of introduction from Casanova, caught by two beasts whose skulls were as flat as spades and whose translucent skin had given Sartori a terrible glimpse of their victim's agony as his head was taken down the throat of one while his legs were devoured by the other. But it was the death of Roxburgh's sister that Gentle remembered with profoundest horror, not least because the man had been at such pains to keep her from coming, and had even abased himself to the maestro, begging him to talk to the woman and persuade her to stay away. He'd had the talk, but he'd knowingly made his caution a seduction, almost literally, in fact, and she'd come to see the reconciliation as much to meet the eyes of the man who'd wooed her with his warnings as for the ceremony itself. She'd paid the most terrible price. She'd been fought over like a bone among hungry wolves, shrieking a prayer for deliverance as a trio of Oviats drew out her entrails and dabbled in her open skull. By the time the maestro, with Pai Opar's help, had raised sufficient fates to drive the entities back into the circle, she was dying in her own coils, thrashing like a fish half filleted by a hook. Only later did the maestro hear of the atrocities visited on the other circles. It was the same story there as in the fifth, the Oviats appearing in the midst of innocence, carnage ensuing, which was only brought to a halt when one of the maestro's assistants drove them back. With the exception of Sartori, the maestros themselves had all perished.
"It would be better if I died like the others," he said to Lucius.
The boy tried to persuade him otherwise, but tears overwhelmed him. There was another voice, however, rising from the bottom of the stairs, raw with grief, but strong.
"Sartori! Sartori!"
He turned. Joshua was there in the hallway, his fine powder-blue coat covered with blood, as were his hands, as was his face.
"What's going to happen?"
he yelled.
"This storm is going to tear the world apart."
"No, Joshua,
don't lie to me. There's never been a storm like this, ever."
"Control yourself."
"Jesus Christ, our Lord, forgive us our trespasses."
"That's not going to help, Joshua." Godolphin had a crucifix in his hand and put it to his lips.
"You godless trash! Are you a demon? Is that it? Were you sent to have our souls?"
Tears were pouring down his crazed face.
"What hell did you come out of?"
"The same as you. The human hell."
"I should have listened to Roxburgh. He knew. He said over and over you had some plan, and I didn't believe him, wouldn't believe him, because Judith loved you, and how could anything so pure love anything unholy? But you hid yourself from her, too, didn't you? Poor, sweet Judith. How did you make her love you? How did you do it?
Is that all you can think of?
Tell me! How?"
Barely coherent in his fury, Godolphin started up the stairs towards the seducer. Gentle felt his hand go to his mouth. Godolphin halted. He knew this power.
"Haven't we shed enough blood tonight?" the maestro said.
"You! Not me!"
Godolphin replied. He jabbed a finger in Gentle's direction, the crucifix hanging from his fist.
"You'll have no peace after this," he said. "Roxburgh's already talking about a purge, and I'm going to give him every guinea he needs to break your back. You and all your works are damned."
"Even Judith?"
"I never want to see that creature again."
"But she's yours, Joshua," the maestro said flatly, descending the stairs as he spoke. "She's yours forever and ever. She won't age. She won't die. She belongs to the family Godolphin until the sun goes out."
"Then I'll kill her."
"And have her innocent soul on your blotted conscience?"
"She's got no soul."
"I promised you Judith to the last, and that's what she is. A religion, a discipline, a sacred mystery. Remember?" Godolphin buried his face in his hands. "She's the one truly innocent soul left among us, Joshua. Preserve her. Love her as you've never loved any living thing, because she's our only victory." He took hold of Godolphin's hands and unmasked him. "Don't be ashamed of our ambition," he said, "and don't believe anyone who tells you it was the devil's doing. We did what we did out of love."
"Which?" Godolphin said. "Making her, or the reconciliation?"
"It's all one," he replied. "Believe that, at least." Godolphin claimed his hands from the maestro's grip.
"I'll never believe anything again," he said,
and turning his back, began his weary descent. Standing on the stairs, watching the memory disappear, Gentle said a second farewell. He had never seen Godolphin again after that night. A few weeks later, the man had retreated to his estate and sealed himself up there, living in silent self-mortification until despair had burst his tender heart.
"It was my fault," said the boy on the stairs behind him.
Gentle had forgotten Lucius was still there, watching and listening. He turned back to the child.
"No," he said, "you're not to blame."
Lucius had wiped the blood from his chin, but he couldn't control his trembling. His teeth chattered between his stumbling words.
"I did everything you told me to do," he said. I swear, but I must have missed some words from the rites, or, I don't know, maybe mixed up the stones."
"What are you talking about?"
"The stones you gave me to replace the flawed ones."
"I gave you no stones, Lucius."
"But, Maestro, you did. 2 stones to go in the circle. You told me to bury the ones I took at the step. Don't you remember?"
Listening to the boy, Gentle finally understood how the reconciliation had come to grief. His other, born in the upper room of this very house, had used Lucius as his agent, sending him to replace a part of the circle with stones that resembled the originals. Forging ran in the blood, knowing they would not preserve the circle's integrity when the ceremony reached its height. But while the man who was remembering these scenes understood how all this had come about, to Maestro Sartori, still ignorant of the other self he'd created in the womb of the doubling circle, this remained an unfathomable mystery.
"I gave you no such instruction," he said to Lucius.
"I understand," the youth replied. "You have to lay the blame at my feet. That's why maestros need adepts. I begged you for the responsibility, and I'm glad to have it, even if I failed."
He reached into his pocket as he spoke.
"Forgive me, maestro," he said,
and drawing out a knife, had it at his heart in the space of a thunderclap. As the tip drew blood, the maestro caught hold of the youth's hand and, wrenching the blade from his fingers, threw it down the stairs.
"Who gave you permission to do that?" he said to Lucius. "I thought you wanted to be an adept."
"I did,"
the boy said.
"And now you're out of love with it. You see humiliation, and you want no more of the business."
"No,"
Lucius protested.
"I still want wisdom, but I failed tonight."
"We all failed tonight," the maestro said.
He took hold of the trembling boy and spoke to him softly.
"I don't know how this tragedy came about," he said. "But I sniff more than your shite in the air. Some plot was here, laid against our high ambition, and perhaps if I hadn't been blinded by my own glory, I'd have seen it. The fault isn't yours, Lucius, and stopping your own life won't bring Abelove or Esther or any of the others back. Listen to me."
"I'm listening."
"Do you still want to be my adept?"
"Of course."
"Will you obey my instructions now to the letter?"
"Anything. Just tell me what you need from me."
"Take my books, all that you can carry, and go as far from here as you're able to go. To the other end of the Imagica, if you can learn the trick of it. Somewhere Roxburgh and his hounds won't ever find you. There's a hard winter coming for men like us. It'll kill all but the cleverest. But you can be clever, can't you?"
"Yes."
"I knew it," the maestro smiled. "You must teach yourself in secret, Lucius, and you must learn to live outside time. That way the years won't wither you, and when Roxburgh's dead you'll be able to try again."
"Where will you be, maestro?"
"Forgotten, if I'm lucky. But never forgiven, I think. That will be too much to hope for." "Don't look so dejected, Lucius. I have to know there's some hope,
and I'm charging you to carry it for me.
It's my honour, Maestro.
As he replied, Gentle was once again grazed by the déjà vu he'd first felt when he'd encountered Lucius outside the dining-room door. But the touch was light and passed before he could make sense of it.
Remember, Lucius, that everything you learn is already part of you, even to the Godhead itself. Study nothing except in the knowledge that you already knew it. Worship nothing except in adoration of your true self, and fear nothing.
There the maestro stopped and shuddered as though he had a presentiment.
Fear nothing except in the certainty that you are your enemy's begetter, and its only hope of healing. For everything that does evil is in pain. Will you remember those things?
The boy looked uncertain.
As best I can, he said.
That will have to suffice, the maestro said. Now, get out of here, before the purgers come.
He let go of the boy's shoulders, and Cobbett retreated down the stairs backwards, like a commoner from the king, only turning and heading away when he was at the bottom. The storm was overhead now, and with the boy gone, taking his sewer stench with him, the smell of electricity was strong. The candle Gentle held flickered, and for an instant he thought it was going to be extinguished, signalling the end of these recollections, at least for tonight. But there was more to come.
That was kind, he heard Pio Pa say,
and turned to see the mistiff standing at the top of the stairs. It had discarded its soiled clothes with its customary fastidiousness, but the plain shirt and trousers it wore were all the finery it needed to appear in perfection. There was no face in the Imagica more beautiful than this, Gentle thought, nor form more graceful, and the scenes of terror and recrimination the storm had brought were of little consequence while he bathed in the sight of it. But the maestro he had been had not yet made the error of losing this miracle, and, seeing the mischief, was more concerned that his deceits had been discovered.
"Were you here when Godolphin came?" he asked.
"Yes."
"Then you know about Judith?"
"I can guess."
"I kept it from you because I knew you wouldn't approve."
"It's not my place to approve or otherwise. I'm not your wife, that you should fear my censure."
"Still, I do. And I thought, well, when the reconciliation was done, this would seem like a little indulgence, and you'd say I deserved it because of what I'd achieved. Now it seems like a crime, and I wish it could be undone."
"Do you? Truly?"
the mischief said. The maestro looked up.
"No, I don't,"
he said, his tone that of a man surprised by a revelation. He started to climb the stairs.
"I suppose I must believe what I told Godolphin about her being our..."
"Victory," Pi prompted, stepping aside to let the summoner step into the meditation room. It was as ever bare.
"Shall I leave you alone?" Pi asked.
"No,"
the maestro said hurriedly. Then, more quietly,
"Please, no."
He went to the window from which he had stood those many evenings watching the nymph Allegra at her toilet. The branches of the tree he'd spied her through thrashed themselves to splinter and pulp against the panes.
"Can you make me forget, Pi Opa? There are such fates, aren't there?"
"Of course. But is that what you want?"
"No. What I really want is death, but I'm too afraid of that at the moment. So, it will have to be forgetfulness."
"The true maestro folds pain into his experience."
"Then I'm not a true maestro," he returned. "I don't have the courage for that. Make me forget, mischief. Divide me from what I've done and what I am forever. Make a fate that'll be a river between me and this moment so that I'm never tempted to cross it."
"How will you live?"
The maestro puzzled over this for a few moments.
"In increments," he finally replied, "each part ignorant of the part before."
"Well, you can do this for me?"
"Certainly."
"It's what I did for the woman I made for Godolphin. Every 10 years she'll start to undo her life and disappear. Then she'll invent another one and live it, never knowing what she left behind."
Listening to himself plot the life he'd lived, Gentle heard a perverse satisfaction in his voice. He had condemned himself to 200 years of waste, but he'd known what he was doing. He'd made the same arrangements precisely for the second Judith, and had contemplated every consequence on her behalf. It wasn't just cowardice that made him shun these memories, it was a kind of revenge upon himself for failing to banish his future to the same limbo he'd made for his creature.
"I'll have pleasure, Pye," he said. "I'll wander the world and enjoy the moments. I just won't have the sum of them."
"And what about me?"
"After this, you're free to go," he said.
"And do what? Be what?"
"Whore or assassin, I don't care," the maestro said.
The remark had been thrown off casually, surely not intended as an order to the mischief. But was it a slave's duty to distinguish between a command made for the humour of it and one to be followed absolutely? No, it was a slave's duty to obey, especially if the dictate came, as did this, from a beloved mouth. Here, with a throwaway remark, the master had circumscribed his servant's life for 2 centuries, driving it to deeds it had doubtless abhorred. Gentle saw the tears shining in the mischief's eyes and felt its suffering like a hammer pounding at his heart. He hated himself then for his arrogance and his carelessness, for not seeing the harm he was doing a creature that only wanted to love him and be near him, and he longed more than ever to be reunited with Pye so that he could beg forgiveness for this cruelty.
"Make me forget," he said again. "I want an end to this."
The mischief was speaking, Gentle saw, though whatever incantations its lips shaped were spoken in a voice he couldn't hear. The breath that bore them made the flame he'd set on the floor flicker, however, and as the mischief instructed its master in forgetfulness, the memories went out with the flame. Gentle rummaged for the box of matches and struck one, using its light to find the smoking wick, then reigniting it. But the night of storm had passed back into history. And Pye O'Pa, beautiful, obedient, loving Pye O'Pa, had gone with it. He sat down in front of the candle and waited, wondering if there was some coda to come. But the house was dead from cellar to eaves.
"So," he said to himself, "what now, maestro?"
He had his answer from his stomach, which made a little thunder of its own.
"You want food?"
he asked it, and it gurgled its reply.
"Me too," he said.
He got up and started down the stairs, preparing himself for a return to modernity. As he reached the bottom, however, he heard something scraping across the bare boards. He raised the candle and his voice.
"Who's there?"
Neither the light nor his demand brought an answer. But the sound went on, and others joined it. None of them pleasant. A low, agonized moan. A wet, dragging sound. A whistling inhalation. What melodrama was his memory preparing to stage for him, he wondered, that had need of these hoary devices? They might have inspired fear in him once upon a time, but not now. He'd seen too many horrors face to face to be chilled by imitations.
"What's this about?"
he asked the shadows, and was somewhat surprised to have his question answered.
"We've waited for you a long time,"
a wheezing voice told him.
"Sometimes we thought you'd never come home," another said.
There was a fluting femininity in its tone. Gentle took a step in the